I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Alan Cumming, and welcome to My Shelves. My shelves are sort of a museum of my life. I like to keep things from my travels that are, to me anyway, the very essence of the experiences I've had. Sort of portals, if you will, to a specific time and place. And the inspiration for stories and memories and musings. Here is a bottle opener, one of those sort of flat ones, and barmen keep them in their back pocket. And once when I was in a bar, I think in New Orleans, and when I get drunk, I sometimes ask to go behind the bar and help out. I love being a barman. And this guy, one of the bar staff, gave me my own special bottle opener as a sort of thank you present. Such an honour to be given. It's like being given a tool of the trade, and it means that I'm a proper craftsman. Not really, though. And today, I'm talking to the amazing Iman.
And he said, well, how much do you want? And I said, 1 year tuition at the university was $7,000. And he said, you got it.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome.
Iman is one of the world's best-known models. She was born in Somalia, but when she was studying at Nairobi University in Kenya, she suddenly became a model when one day she bumped into the photographer Peter Beard on the street. Her modelling career is international, huge, and legendary. She also became an actress, she is a philanthropist, and an entrepreneur. Her company, Iman Cosmetics, to this day is one of the most successful cosmetics firms in the world. She's also hilarious and the best person to go to a party with. I spoke to Iman earlier this year when I was in quarantine in Australia. And I have to say that this episode of Alan Cumming Shelves is a super duper one because the thing that Iman and I are talking about is not from my shelves at all. So, Iman, the thing I'm talking about today is not actually on my shelves, Alan Cumming's shelves. It's kind of near my shelves. It's outside, and it's really Alan Cumming's garden. Today, this podcast is being retitled Alan Cumming's Garden because yes. I don't know if you remember, but do you remember you came to lunch at our house upstate once, and we went out into the garden because we had this lovely girl called Grace. Doing our garden and, you know, sort of design, you know, making some beds and doing things. And we were making a fire pit. We're going to have a fire pit. And she came in and said, you know, you have to choose because we're digging the hole to make the fire pit. So we went out, you and me and Grant, my husband, went out. And I sort of said where I thought the fire pit we should go. And you were just like, no, Alan, that's a terrible idea. You must put it over here so when you can see the view, you can see the sky and the moon. And if, you know, if even you're sitting there in the evening, you can still see the view of the hills. And, you know, you're absolutely right. And so we have named the fire pit the Iman fire pit in your honor.
I have to come back to see it.
Yes, it is. And, you know, you're absolutely right. It was such a stupid idea. If I put it in the other place, we'd have just been sort of looking at the house. And now when you sit at it, you can look out and see the hills. And so it's always forever been the Iman Memorial Fire Pit. So thank you.
Lovely.
Thank you for that.
Lovely. I'm glad I was of service.
Yeah, you were. And also what was a hilarious thing, I don't know if I ever told you this bit, but Grace the gardener, she said, like, because Anthony, our guy who looks after our house, he was helping dig the hole. And yes. So I don't think she knew you were there. And so when you came out with me and Grant, I went, oh, this is Iman, this is Grace, this is Anthony. And she was a bit sort of, you know, seemed a bit starstruck, I thought. And we went back in to have our lunch. And Anthony told me that after, when we went in, she just turned to him and said, please tell me they're not going swimming. And I don't quite know what that means. Like, that the thought of you in a swimsuit would just send her, I don't know, the thought of the combo of us all in swimsuit.
Yeah, it'll take her over the edge.
Yeah, yes, I think that's what she meant. She might have expired. You're dangerous. You're dangerous, oh, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm turning 66 in July.
What? So I think
I'm a grandma.
Wow.
My older daughter has a 3-year-old who they're coming to visit me in July.
Nice.
And then David's son has two little ones. And
does he have two? Gosh.
Yeah. So I'm a grandma of three. So I think my danger years are over.
You always strike me as someone who's been very sort of sanguine about getting older and, you know, all that stuff and about the way that sort of attitudes change about women as they get older. How are you feeling about being 66, for example?
I have absolutely no problem with it. Being African, we actually, like, especially Somalis, we don't really celebrate birthdays. Because most people don't even know when they're born. It's a privilege getting older, right? Mm. So for us, it's always has been a privilege to get older. And we definitely are very appreciative and very close to our elders. I'm fine with it. You know, with the exception, I mean, I still feel inside like I'm 30, but till I get up and then, ouch, what was that?
I know that one, yeah.
So I think health is wealth. So as long as one can hope to be healthy and stay healthy, you know, the rest is really a privilege.
It's butter. I totally agree. It's so funny. The thing I'm doing here in Australia, I'm going on tour. My show is called Alan Cumming Is Not Acting His Age. And it's been really interesting because I'm talking a lot about, you know, what is age appropriate? You know, who says you've got to behave a certain way? And actually, who makes those rules? And I think that's sort of, we get mixed messages all the time about we should look young, we should do all these things, and then we should grow up and we should, you know, act our age. It's really weird, don't you think?
Exactly. And nobody can ever say that you have acted your age, because you don't.
Well, thanks. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it is a mixed messages. It is like trying to be relevant, and people think by being irrelevant means to be hip and young,
yes,
which it's not,
yes,
because you can be 80 and be relevant. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So, yeah, exactly. And, I think it's a very West mentality about trying to hold on to youth, and specifically in terms of women and how they look. I see a lot of women that have they don't want an ounce of fat on their body, right? So they lose all the weight, and so they're skinny as hell on their body, and of course that affects your face. And then they put fillers on the face, you know.
Yeah.
So and I have no idea who has told them that looks normal, because they don't look normal.
Do you know, what I think is the worst thing? Is some, you know, when you see someone sometimes and they've had stuff done, and the weirdest thing I feel is when people have had stuff done and they don't mention it to you, like friends. I think you've just got to go, oh, okay, it's like the elephant in the room, no one's talking about it. But what I think is weird is when people, you know, you see someone and everyone goes, oh, don't they look great? Oh, they look so good. And I want to go, no, they look crazy. They look like someone's, you know, like they've been in a fire or something. Do you know what I mean? It's just awful. And it's this sort of conspiracy of silence.
And the same thing applies to clothing. You know, people say, you know, obviously, I mean, I was listening to the news this morning, and one of the things that they said that was back in fashion was like the crop top. And they were talking about what age do you not wear a crop top? I'm like, at 13, maybe? That's, you know, but at the same time, there is all these rules about what you can wear. If you look, I mean, if you look fine and you're happy with yourself, whether you're a plus size or a size two, it doesn't matter. I mean, I see plus size, beautiful plus size women who are wearing crop tops and really, really look great in it. And it's, totally. You know, it's really about the confidence that one feels about themselves and how they feel comfortable in their own skin. And then I've heard about this weird thing about also is like that there is, because of people who are doing a lot of Zoom businesses and meetings and all that, and the plastic surgery, especially on face, have quadrupled.
Yes. No, I can believe
and I'm
it.
Like, I know, I'm like, bitch, get yourself a good lighting. Forget about the...
that's true. Get a filter.
Get a filter, yeah. This is crazy. You can't just go and have something done to your face because you don't look good on Zoom. Put the camera up.
You know, I was just going to say that. You know, that's the thing that I think has been the most amazing thing about this pandemic and everyone on Zoom is that everyone understands angles, like always from above, especially after 50, in every area of life. And also, get some lighting on you. Don't you know, look at the thing. I just can't understand why when you get on a Zoom and you're looking up somebody's nose and half their face is in shadow, I'm like, come on, people.
Get it together.
2021. Yeah, really.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, I'm really fascinated about this, so when you started to become a model, you were at university in Egypt, was it?
No, I was going to university in Nairobi, Kenya.
Oh, in Kenya.
I went to high school in Egypt, but I was going to Nairobi University. But I was a refugee, you know. My father was an ambassador for so many years, and then all of a sudden we had a coup in Somalia, so we all came back to Somalia, and then they started arresting and actually executing a lot of people who were with the ex-government. So one night my mom decided that she hired a van, and in the middle of the night just took us in the van with just the clothes on our back, went to the border of Kenya, and literally crossed over by foot from Somalia to Kenya and became refugees.
Wow.
I was like 16 years old.
Gosh.
And so it was like, very scary because as a young girl, and then we were separated. And
why were you separated?
Because my parents just wanted to go to Tanzania. They didn't want to stay in Kenya. I wanted to stay in Kenya, so I decided that I would stay in Kenya. So they separated the family. The ones who wanted to go to Tanzania went to Tanzania. But I wanted to go to school in Nairobi, and Nairobi University. So
right.
But there is non-government organizations that were on the ground. So that to me, they're like the angels that who walk among us, because that these are people who are commit themselves to taking care in this environment. They leave their families and come to in hot spots and deal with refugees and all that. Yeah. But they were so protective of me that if I didn't have that, I don't know what my trajectory would have been, because, you know, as a 16 years old, anything could happen, rape, sexual molestation, you know, kidnapping. Yes. I was on my own. But they were really like those people who took care of me. So they really took care of me on the ground, and that was my safe haven.
And that was the UN refugee people.
They were from the United Nations at that time,
they're amazing.
They are. That's why I've become now a global ambassador for an organization called the oldest organization, actually charitable organization in the world. CARE. I've become their global advocate specifically to help in the refugees communities and specifically dealing with girls and women issues.
Because I saw what has
been done for me, so it's passing it forward. Yeah.
Yeah. That, you know, I did a thing. I've done a couple of things with the UN, with the refugees, part of the UN, and a UNHCR, it's called. And I went, it was one of these, you know, sort of just these moments where you just think, oh my God, I'm so lucky and I've got such privilege. I went to Lebanon. And so I was when, you know, all these refugees from Syria and Iraq. And at the point I was there, and I can't imagine it's got any better. I can only imagine it's got worse, actually. Well, maybe not now, but it was 30% of the population of Lebanon was made up of refugees. Yes. And I just thought that was incredible. I could just imagine any other country. I mean, and I said, how are they coping? How is everyone coping? I said, well, you know, this, we're kind of used to it here. We're used to the sort of transference of people from different countries because of conflict. So it's sort of in our culture. We welcome people in that way. And it's just it's another world. Just imagine, like, you know, people in the amount, it was like 12,000 refugees came into America that year, that same year, something ridiculous like that. But I met these people, and there's actually a boy that I met there who I kept in touch with, who lives in Holland. He got transferred, I can't remember what you call it, but, you know, Holland took him, and he was an at-risk refugee. And it's just so, to see people who've gone through like the worst things that could possibly happen to you, and just trying to make a life again in another culture. It was actually a really life-changing few days for me. And also there was a hilarious moment, because one of the things they do there is in Lebanon, they have people make holiday homes, but they don't always finish them. They kind of they take many years to finish them. They just go back and do a bit more work on them, and then come back and do a bit more work. So there's all these sort of half finished holiday homes. And so they were putting refugees into these places. And when we got there, they were showing me, you know, and there was a film crew and everything, and they were showing me that, and there was two families in this one little house, and I felt so bad, and they had given me this sort of little box of vegan snacks for my lunch, and I just went into the car, the SUV, which was one of these SUVs. When I got into it, they told me it was an armored one; it could withstand a rocket. I was like, oh, good to know. And then I got my vegan snacks. And I said to the, you know, through the translator, here the kids should have these. And right at that moment, there was all this shouting and people with guns appeared. And I thought, in my dopiness, I thought that they were angry with me because I'd given my vegan snacks away to the refugees. And it was actually these people, because Hamas were governed that area of southern Lebanon. And so it was people from the sort of Hamas Secret Service who hadn't got the memo that the UN were coming, and they wondered what was all the SUVs were for, and the film crew and everything. And there was all this shouting and guns, and the UN people were saying things like, oh, I think we should, we really want you to go to the other villa and see, you know, what it's like after these have been winterized. And I said, I can imagine, you know, we can just, you could just take a picture of it and we can just do that.
Yeah, we've seen one.
Don't you? yes. I said, I don't think we should argue with these men. But the worst part of all was I really thought it was my fault for giving them my vegan snacks. That's why
Lebanon. I went to high school in Egypt. So around 1966, 67, we used to go for weekends to Lebanon. Lebanon was considered the Paris of Middle East.
Yes.
It was
yes.
the most beautiful city. And they had this, and actually some of their mountains, that you can get snow peaks on it. It was the most gorgeous, gorgeous city ever, right? So we used to go. We used to go there for the weekends.
And very, very liberal, wasn't it? Very sort of progressive.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was the most progressive and most liberal in the Middle East countries at that time. So I have a very memorable times that I've spent when I was in my teenager, or younger even, in Lebanon. But it was coming back again, like there are major designers who are from there and who have their houses there, like Ali Saab and Zuhair Murad and all of that, they're there. But I've heard also now the latest conflict that was going on in Palestine between the Israelis and when Hamas. I heard that a lot of in Lebanon, they've been bombed this time around with the conflict. But yeah, it's been it's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful place, and it has stunning. And it has the most beautiful homes. Yeah, I remember the most beautiful homes. Yeah.
So you were in Kenya at university, and then how? And it was Peter Beard, wasn't it? Was the photographer that first
that
sort of
that discovered me?
Discovered you. I love that phrase. Discovered, like you're under a rock or something. And
I know that's what I always say. I was not lost to be discovered.
Yes. Yeah. So how did that happen? Because you don't imagine, it's normally things like Naomi, you know, it's like in a shopping mall in East London or something, but you don't hear about it in Nairobi.
Exactly. Well, he lived in Kenya.
Oh, did he?
And he lived in Kenya for years and years because all his books on it, he's really,
oh, he's
really,
got all the books. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, no, he lived in Kenya. And so I was going to Nairobi University, but I also had two side jobs. One was as a translator. I was translating for the Ministry of Tourism, all their brochures, because I spoke five languages. And specifically, they were having an influx of Italian tourists who didn't speak English. So I was translating all the brochures from English to Italian.
Ah, wow.
And then also I was a waitress in one of the big hotels. The restaurant was called the Stanley Hotel, Nairobi Stanley Hotel. So I was going from one job to the other when Peter Beard stopped me in the street. He walked to me and he introduced himself. I didn't pay him any attention. I kept on walking. And then he said to me, you know, have you ever been photographed? And I thought, oh, dear God, white people, they think we've never seen cameras. And hilarious. I said, yes. Yeah, I said, yes. And he said, by whom? And I said, by my parents. And he said, no, I mean professionally. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And I said, the only thing I remember, I've never seen fashion magazines. I've never worn heels or makeup or that, you know. So I was not aware of what he was talking about. And so he kept on still walking with me. And then he said, well, what did you do? I said, I work at the restaurant here and I'm going to the university. And then he said, I would love to take your pictures. And I was very suspicious. I had no idea what he was talking about.
Oh, I bet you would, Peter Beard. Yeah,
exactly. And then he said to me, no, it's only headshots, right? And and then he said, and you can bring somebody with you. And then I still was not interested. And then he said the magic word. He said, I will pay you. And that stopped me. And I said, how much? And he said, well, how much do you want? And I said, 1 year tuition at the university was $7,000 equivalent.
Wow.
And he said, you got it.
What?
So that was my first business exchange.
Look at you.
He did that. I posed for the pictures. I brought two friends with me, posed for the pictures. And that was the end of that. So I thought. And the next thing is that I'm staying in a hot place where I don't have any phone. A friend of mine worked at Pan Am. He knew her. He went to New York. He came to New York and he had a gallery exhibition of his photographs. And on the invitation was my picture. Wilhelmina Modeling Agency, Wilhelmina herself was alive then, saw the picture. This is in 1975. Saw the picture of me, and she asked him, I would like her to bring her to the United States to be a model. So he called my friend. He told her to get me there. I got to her office. Wilhelmina and
Can I interrupt you? So what did so how long was it since you'd done the pictures before you saw this invitation thing with your
No, I didn't see the invitation. I didn't see the invitation until I got to America. No, I had no idea.
So you just got on a plane thinking, all right, I'm just going to go and be a model. But just like, I mean, that seems ballsy for a young woman.
I asked for the only thing I asked, because she was talking about money and I had no clue what they were talking about. And mind you, I'm not 18 yet. So I don't even have a passport. So I have to ask permission to my parents, but I knew that they will never let me. So first I asked for a return ticket. I didn't want to get stuck in New York without a return ticket. So in case things go bad, I can always go home, right? The second thing, I lied about my age to get a passport. My parents didn't know I was leaving the country.
So you didn't ask them. You didn't ask your parents at all. You just lied.
Nope. Yep. I got a passport.
So that was a good thing about people in Africa not really knowing when they're born and not saying
Well, no, this was bold lie. But my intention was to come to the to New York, check what's going on, what this is about, and then go back home. And that's been since 1975.
Wow.
And I'm still here. And I'm still here. I haven't cashed my return ticket, but I still have the return ticket.
Do you really?
Yes,
you still have it.
I still have it.
Oh, wow. When did your parents know that you'd gone?
You will not believe it. So the first week I got here, there was press and all that was written about me because Peter Beard fabricated a story. I found out in the jungle. I was like, what?
Oh, my God.
She doesn't speak a word of English. I speak five languages.
Oh, my God.
And there was a picture of me appeared in Newsweek, and that's one of the only magazines that my father reads.
No.
That's how my parents found out I was in New York and not in Nairobi.
Oh, were they furious?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You think I went into prostitution? Because I was majoring in political science. They were like, what? What the hell is modeling? What are you doing? So... But it afforded me, that 1 year of modeling afforded me to be able to take care of my parents, to make sure that my brothers and sisters were able to finish their schools, go back to school. So that's what modeling really was able to do for me. It was pure business. I went into modeling really to be able to take care of my family.
I love that you asked for $7,000 straight off the bat. I mean, that must have been a huge amount to sort of, I mean, people would normally do that for free, wouldn't they, to a big...
No, well, like I've that. Always, I was raised by my mother to always know my worth.
Totally.
She always said, ask for the, because she's, I remember years ago when I was little, she asked me, if God granted you a wish, what would you wish for? And it took me a while to answer, and she said, you know what, you're not worth the wish. I said, why? I was thinking about it. And she, you know what she said, always ask for the moon and then you can come to, you can negotiate down. Ask for the moon. Yeah.
Oh, wise women. I love that.
Yes. So that's what I did.
Hello and welcome to Out to Lunch with me, Jay Rayner, the podcast in which I take a particularly brilliant famous person to a top restaurant and grill them to a turn. In this latest season, you'll find me having delicious dinners with the likes of Patrick Keelty, David Hare, Nina Conti, Dame Eileen Atkins and Mary Beard, and the reliably outrageous Miriam Margolyes.
Richard E. Grant was on that.
He has an always compulsion to smell whatever's around him. Has he never come and sniffed you?
Probably wisely, no.
All that and so much more. So do join me. Out to Lunch with Jay Rayner. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
How did you I mean, it sounds a stupid question, actually, but how did you know how to model? If you never saw a fashion magazine, you never saw those things. I mean...
No, I learned on the job. No, I have... first of all, I didn't even know how to walk in heels. So I really learned on the job. Really, literally learned on the job. It's like I mimicked what the girls were doing. Right? And right. I was always in fear of that they'll find out... Well, they could see it, but other they'll find out that I'm not worth all this money that they're, whatever they're giving me, that, you know. But it is that pure survival of a refugee. We adapt. We know how to survive and make it through. And so that's what it was. For me, it was a survival mode. It's like, I need to learn, if I'm going to be in this, I need to learn this quite fast, and that's what I did. I mimicked what the girls were doing. I was just looking and watching and learning on the job.
And then you, like, quite soon after that, you became an actress too. How was that for you, like, going into that world?
It's obviously completely a different world than what modeling is, but it requires much more of a commitment than modeling. You know what I mean? And I was not able to really fulfill that, because it really, you know, a model, you can learn, as I said, you can learn on the job. Acting, you can learn on the job. You really need to take classes. You really need a major more commitment than modeling. So I stayed on that, on my lane as a model. I didn't pursue acting.
Oh, I see. But you did. You did quite a. I mean, you did quite a lot of things, didn't you? I mean, you did lots of films and.
I did not lots. I think maybe 4 or 5. Yeah, that's not lots. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you made a very big impression. You also did lots of commercials. I remember you, like, the first time I was aware of you was a commercial in Britain. I don't know what it was for, but you had this. I think you had a big sort of headdress on.
Tia Maria,
that's right. Yeah. That was amazing. You were walking around and everyone's looking at you, and you had this big headdress, and you seemed really confident and, like...
Actually, the headdress was my hair.
Oh, was it? Oh.
that was the 80s. That was the hair. That was that big.
That's hilarious.
No, the Tia Maria, she was huge. It became like such a huge commercial.
Yeah.
That I had to literally, because I'm Muslim, I had to literally convince my parents, because they were like, I had to convince them that it was not alcoholic.
they were like, it's true what we thought. She's going
I
to
was like, no, it's one of those cheap drinks. It's not alcoholic.
That's hilarious. Another hilarious time I remember with you is when... You had one of your books. It was called The Beauty of Color.
Yes,
it was about. It was such a beautiful book, actually, of all these women of color and just they're photographed really beautifully, and you interviewed them and stuff. And I remember I was in LA shooting something, and you said, "Oh, would you like to come and be my date for the party was the launch of it?" And it was such fun. I remember, and actually, you came over to pick me up at the hotel I was staying in, and I'm going to read to you. I wrote about this in a book, and I said, because I took some photos of you.
Yes.
And I love, there's a picture I'm looking at right now that I took of you. And I said, Iman is the perfect model. I mean, she is always conscious of the camera and knows exactly how to project any emotion. She's like a silent movie star. She's also totally hilarious. And I remember that night, we took these great pictures, we had some drinks, and then we went to the party, and it was... It was in that...
Roosevelt
Hotel. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. It was such fun. And I remember, the thing I remember that night was that I was kind of like, you know, we're with you and with some of your friends and other people. And at one point you said to me, I've got to go and do a TV interview. Will you look after my handbag, my purse?
Yes.
And I was like, okay. And so I was sort of standing there and chatting to people. And then I really needed to go to the loo. And so I said to Janice Dickinson,
Right. Oh, dear
this
God.
I know. This is like already it was a bad idea. Just even saying her name. I said, Janice, I'm really bursting for a pee. Could you look after Iman's bag? I mustn't lose it. She told me I've got to be very careful with this bag. Can you look after her bag once I go to the... She goes, sure, honey. So I go off to have a pee. I come back and I go, where's the bag? She goes, what? And I'm like, Janice! I've lost a man's bag. And it was, thankfully, it was just on a chair somewhere. She just left it. But I just thought, oh my God, you do not want to lose the hostess of the evening's handbag.
She's probably went through it and couldn't find anything.
Janice, how is she doing? I haven't seen her for absolutely ages.
I haven't seen her since then. Yeah, I haven't. She's been through a couple of things, but you know, like everybody, like life as is. But I haven't. Yeah, I haven't seen. But no, I remember. I remember. She's so crazy. Yeah, she said. Yeah, she probably went through it, and she said, "Oh, damn it! There's nothing in here."
And it was so funny actually, because I remember that night I used to do a thing where I would, like, sort of take, like, it was kind of before selfies, but I had my camera, and I would sort of hold it out in front. I would say, do happy, sad, happy, angry, sad. And I would get people to I'd just say happy, and we'd be happy. I'd say angry, angry, and sad. That was just a thing I did. And so I was doing it with Janice, and then I looked at the little screen on the digital camera. I was like, oh, Janice, I don't know, you've got to do different faces for each time. All your faces kind of look the same. I mean, I said, one more time, happy, angry, sad. And then she went, Alan, my face doesn't move that much.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It's the same.
Do you know what I always wondered about models is that, because I, like with actors, I sort of, you know, sometimes a lot of actors all hang out and all talk shop, and it's actually, I don't like it. I think actors in a group are kind of boring, and it doesn't really, I don't really like it. I don't like to sort of, you know, like I don't really, I have some friends who have actors, but they're in the minority. Most of my friends, my close friends, aren't actors at all. But I wondered if models all hang out. Was it in the 80s when it was all the all those big supermodels? Did you all hang out together and chat about modeling?
We do, because it's like, I compare it to like the circus, you're right. So we will come to Paris, right? We'll all be traveling together. We all stay in the same hotel together. And we'll be doing the shows. And the shows are really, they're built tents. So literally, it is like a circus.
Yes, I see.
And but we travel together. We eat together, you know. But it is a condensed time. So once the shows are over, because it's like we go from Milan to Paris to London, then New York. Once that the shows are over, everybody have a separate life. Have a separate life. So it's that way. Some of them become like chosen family, so they become like very close. And others drift off. Like, I mean, I used to be very close to Janice, you know, way like years ago. But then I haven't seen her for over 25 years.
Wow. Gosh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Don't you, or haven't you modeled for your own company and stuff?
Yes, I still do shoots. You know, I just did a whole big cover and pages for UK Bazaar. But it's always about what my cosmetic company is, and what, you know, rather than just being a model, right? So So in that way, yeah. I mean, I'm still, people, when I say I've retired from modeling, they say, but I just saw your pictures. Yes, but it's in a different context.
Right.
Yeah.
And you don't miss that sort of that time of traveling all over the world and being in a group with everybody and all that sort of fun.
No, because it is really hard work. And it gives you a sense. I mean, for me, it's because first, as being a Somali, we are nomads, so I'm used to just, you know, picking my bag up, my bag, and go wherever, you know. So I'm used to that. And then as a refugee, I feel like displaced. So I'm comfortable in any area. But, you know, once I start having children, I'm like, I want to settle down, because then now all of a sudden, you know, school year dictates when you travel, you know. So then my life changes,
We talks shortly after 9/11, and because we'd both sort of escaped upstate when you could get out of New York. And I remember that you just talk, it was something that's always struck me, that you said it because one of the terrorists had the same last name as you. Is that right?
Yes.
I remember you said that when you realised that, you just went straight to an ATM machine and got lots of money out and left the city because you just knew it was going to be really problematic to be a Muslim and to have this, you know, be associated in any way with that thing. What was that like, that time for you?
It is because at that time I remember also a lot of taxi drivers felt very unsafe because there are a lot of Pakistanis and, you know, people who are Muslims who are taxi drivers. But what I remember is that because I live in Soho, that there was a barricade with police on Houston Street, right? So you could not, if you wanted to come below Houston, you have to provide proof that you live in the area. You cannot just come in. And I had a hard time because I didn't want to show my ID because it's a Muslim name, and it had one of the terrorists' last name was the same, I believe, Abdul Majid or Majid, like my last name. And so, I felt unsafe. But what kicked in immediately is what it feels to be a refugee. You can move around with credit card. You need cash to move around.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what I did. I just went to the bank and I just took as much money as I could so that I'll be able to move around safely in the city and get out of the city with cash. No, I don't have to show IDs. I don't have to.
Yes, I see. Yeah. So, and were you, because I was, it was on Tuesday that, because it's actually, it's 20 years now this year. It's going to be 20 years.
Amazing.
September 11th. It's incredible. But so Tuesday it happened. And I think it was on Saturday that you were allowed out of the city because when the bridges and tunnels were open again. Well, so were you, you were in the city till then and then you got out as well.
And then I got out. Yeah. I actually couldn't come back into Houston Street because then I had to show ID. Right. I went to a friend of mine who lives near Washington Square. I went to stay with her. David was recording in upstate, so we were separated.
Oh, gosh,
and that's why he was saying, "You get out of the city, come." And I said, "I'm trying. We just can't.
Yeah, we're trapped.
The bridges and everything were closed. Yeah, so I stayed with a friend, and then on that weekend when it opened, I left.
Right. I remember that was such an, well, it was a crazy time. But the thing I remember driving upstate was, you know, on outside churches, they have those sort of signs saying, you know, God is everywhere or whatever. Those kind of like little signs they can get. Like, this week, you know, potluck lunch or blah, blah, blah. And all the crazy things. And my favorite one is God is inside you or something like that. All these hilarious, Jesus is inside you. I was like, oh, really?
Yes.
But they have all those signs on the way upstate said things like, we will revenge, we will get our revenge, America will fight back. It was all these really aggressive, violent signs on these places of worship. And I found that really disturbing, that the sort of, you know, the churches became sort of weaponized, the language of churches became weaponized.
It felt like, a lot of people felt like it was a crusade, you know? It was like back to the crusade era, like it was religion against religion rather than a certain group of people have decided to do this act. It was, was not a religious act, right? I remember weeks after that when I came back to the city and I was in a taxi and this guy was talking to me. And he and I told him that I was Muslim, so he'll be able to talk freely with me. And he said, no, they were really scared that nobody would, wouldn't come out. The drivers, they stayed at home because, they felt unsafe, you know, and people were attacking them, you know, when they see their names, you know.
It's happening now, people with Asian people being attacked in America. Like
and Jews, by the way.
And Jews now,
it has gone crazy. It's gone crazy. But you know, this is something that's been happening for the past 4-6 years.
Exactly.
Seed has been planted and they're reaping what they're sowing. You know what I mean?
I know.
It's just
it's going to take such a long time to recondition people to be decent again.
Yeah, to be decent again. I mean, I was sort of shocked. I mean, I remember, and I saw there were Free Palestine and Palestine, people who were opposing about these. They wanted a ceasefire. They wanted, you know, all these. But then I saw all of a sudden people beating up a Jewish guy in the city.
And I saw that just on Times Square. I saw that on a video of that. It was just like shocking.
It went crazy. You know, well, no wonder the Holocaust. And I was like, what is going on? What's going on? But then you say, really? Well, we know what's going on. This has been going on for 4 years, and now people have been given the permission to be as ugly as they can be.
Well, it just makes it more important to be good and decent and to spread love throughout the world, Iman, and that is
humanity. I mean, that humanity is that word that we need to really bring it back. People need to know how the other feels. You can't just say things that you think that are not going to affect people. You cannot do actions that you don't think that it's not going to affect people. Where is the humanity? I mean, that's what's missing, that the people have no feeling for others.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you so much, Iman, for talking to me.
Oh, it was so lovely, yes. And let's hang out when you get back.
Yeah, when I get back from Australia, I'll come and visit, and I'll maybe tell you where to put your fire pit.
I beg your pardon.
that's not a euphemism, by the way.
Okay, all right, love.
Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon. Well, I think it's time for me to go outside and have a look at my Iman Memorial Fire Pit, enjoy the view, and maybe cook a vegan sausage or two. I hope you'll join me next time for more fun on Alan Cumming's Shelves. Alan Cumming's Shelves is hosted by me, Alan Cumming, and produced by the lovely Jack Claremont. We are part of the Acast Creator Network and the Crowd Network too. We just love networks. Another Crowd Network podcast to check out is Death of a Film Star. These are the stories of Hollywood icons like Heath Ledger, Carrie Fisher, Robin Williams and more. They're beautifully written episodes all around 25 minutes long, and they pay tribute to some of the greatest actors that have ever been. The episode about Chadwick Boseman is brilliant. So check it out. Just search for Death of a Film Star in your podcast app.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.